This interview is being conducted with Captain Michael P. Sullivan by Master Sergeant Robert H. Oliva at Marine Corps Schools, Quantico, Virginia, on 12 January 1966. The subject of this interview is F-4B ground and air problems. The subject is unclassified. Captain Sullivan, would you state your name, grade, and service number, please?
All right. Captain Michael P. Sullivan, 072005, U.S. Marine Corps.
What were your duty assignments while you were in Vietnam?
I was a member of Marine Fighter Attack Squadron 531, and my job in Vietnam was the line division officer, which encompassed all flight line ops and ground handling equipment supervision.
What periods did you serve in these billets, and where were you physically located within Vietnam during the period covered?
I was in Vietnam from 10 April to approximately, I think, 14 June 1965, located at Da Nang Air Base.
What type of aircraft did you fly, sir?
I flew the F-4B Phantom II in 531.
What do you think of the combat capabilities of this aircraft?
Well, the capabilities of the F-4, I believe it's the finest dual-purpose aircraft we have in our inventory today, can adapt to any tactical mission that we have. However, the limitations is that for the war in Vietnam, 90% of our missions, we should have had the gun pod on the aircraft. It's definitely a need for the 20-millimeter cannon, and also our TPQ missions utilizing the ASRAT were completely avoided many times due to the fact that we did not have the beacon aboard the aircraft, such as the A-4s do. And this could be alleviated by either installing the box in production or adapting a rig, like cutting a bomb in half and putting the beacon itself in the bomb, putting it under the rack of the airplane so the ASRAT can pick you up and you'll be able to drop in bad weather conditions, which has the best effect on the TPQ.
How many missions did you fly, sir?
I flew 103 combat missions in Vietnam.
Could you give a brief description of a normal mission?
Right. Well, about 60% of our missions were strictly interdiction mission strikes. We had no ground component involved. We'd be up to, well, the maximum mission we flew was 360 miles away from Da Nang. Of course, the minimum would be about 3 miles away, but we had a bird dog aircraft, which is L-19 airborne U.S. Air Force controller. We'd be briefed on the target or the rendezvous point, anyhow, before takeoff. We'd proceed out there. The Air Force airplane would mark the target or give us instructions to the target, and then we would hit it. We had about 30% of our missions were either standing MAF alert, which we launched airplanes in support of Marine ground forces or other services in trouble, or we had close air support missions scheduled. We had column escort. We had a night close air support with the Marine Corps. We'd be launched on a MAF alert at dusk or at night, and again, the Marine Corps did not have any flares whatsoever, and the only light we got was from the fires that we started with our own bombs and rockets. Utilizing, working with the ARVN, the U.S. Air Force was out there with their C-123s. They did have flares, and it worked out real well. They illuminated at about 7,000 feet. The flares went out about 3,000. We had good visibility. It's about the darkest portion would be about like the darkest portion of a outfield in a night baseball game, and also we did helo escort and a few column escorts for mechanized columns that would go down, say, from Chu Lai to Quang Nai and back again.
Was your training adequate prior to going to Vietnam?
Yes, it was, probably more so than probably any other F-4 squadron that will go out there, due to the fact that our squadron was together for 3 years. At least half the personnel in that squadron were in it for a three-year period, which included the Cuban flap and many prolonged periods of under pressure and tension of care quals and deployments, transpacts, demonstrations down in Okinawa, et cetera, and plus the fact that the other people in the squadron had been in it for 2 years. Again, the air crew, the experience gained was better than average that you'll find in the normal squadron, because of the time being together, but where it really paid off was with our ground troops, the maintenance people. And again, having the Cuban flap pushed upon us with only 6 months in the airplane, working 24 hours, and we had good part supply. and then going overseas again and down to Vietnam. Again, our airplanes held up real well, and the experience gained in the airplane with our mechanics in 3-year period is what made it very beneficial, and also gave us the availability rate, which was approximately 13 and a half airplanes for a 60-day period up every morning. And again, we might shut down the day with only 4 birds up, but we made every mission. We lost a few sorties, but we had many days where we had add-on missions. And again, I think in April we had 14 out of 15 up every morning. In May we had 13 out of 15. And then again in June we had 14 out of 15 as far as maintenance went. Getting back to the experience level again, the fact that our squadron was primarily a fighter squadron, and that's what it had trained for actually for 2.5 years, we were really primed and ready to go, and we had seen one, the Cuban flap. However, then all of a sudden the attack capability was presented to us. We had approximately 2 months of attack work during Philippine deployments prior to going to Vietnam, and when we got down there, of course, we really went into it. But it proves one thing, that anybody can drop a bomb. And to be an attack pilot, if you can fly a mere approach or just fly an airplane well, anybody can drop a bomb, especially 500-pounders. And, of course, you get about 5 or 6 hops under your belt, and everybody gets to be pretty good at it. We never had any night flare work prior to going down there. But, again, this it's nice to have everybody. It makes it sound like it's a big, hairy deal, but it really isn't. Our least experienced man, again, he had 2 years in the airplane, but nobody had any problems with it whatsoever. And we found out, actually, a lot of interesting points, I'm sure, which were known in the past about it.
Give a brief description of the air control used in close air support.
Okay, well, first of all, the close air support type missions, we either had a forward air controller on the ground, Marine, which did a fairly good job, or we had an airborne forward air controller, which was the U.S. Air Force or the Marine Corps. The U.S. Air Force was outstanding. We couldn't have been better. We never used the close air support charts that they give you for the mission that the FAC gives to you. The Air Force controller would just give us a brief description of where it was best running and heading, and he'd mark it, or a few other pertinent facts as we were rolling into the target or approaching it, and that's all that was needed. However, I found that the Marine airborne FACs were unsatisfactory. And an incident that I'll recite here will bear this point. And that's that I think it was 14 May or something. I was the flight leader on a 4-plane flight that was launched out of Da Nang on the MAF alert at dusk. We got down to the target. It was 900-foot overcast. We broke through, and luckily about a mile in front of us was the rendezvous point, which we were briefed to go to. And again, I had these 3 wingmen tucked in on me so they could we could keep our flight integrity. We broke out at about 900 feet. I called the, it was a deadlock aircraft. I think, again, it was 161. I called him and asked him what his position was, because I didn't see him at the rendezvous point, and he came back with, "Over here." And I was so mad then that if I had seen him, I'd have shot him down. And I said, "Well, we're at the rendezvous point now. Where are you in relation to that?" And he came back and he says, "Well, I'm near the mountains." Well, if you look, the whole coast there was mountains north to south. Finally, we got together and we made our runs. Well, after the mission was over, I told him that we were ammo minus or negative, and that we were returning to base and would like a damage report. He came back and he asked me to make a strafing attack, and I told him negative on that. Then he said, "Well, you mean nobody can make a strafing attack?" And I said, "That's affirmative, no strafing attack." Well, finally, he kept persisting, and I finally came on the air and I told him, "Well, the F-4B doesn't have any guns." Well, he didn't even know about this, which was very, very poor. One other misuse of the aircraft was down at Quang Nai in this mechanized column escort I was on one day. I got down there just as the column was pulling in from Chu Lai into the compound at Quang Nai. And again, we orbited for an hour and 15 minutes overhead while they ate their lunch in a fortified position, and then they pulled out and we gave them 15 minutes air support. Now, what should have been done is somebody should have gotten on the horn, either the air liaison officer, an FAC, or battalion commander, who's ever running the show down there, called back to Da Nang and told us to keep the birds on the deck until they were leaving this area, because we can use these planes for other missions other than orbiting while somebody eats their lunch.
What problems did you encounter in locating targets, sir?
Well, we actually didn't have too many due to the fact that 99% of our missions, the targets were marked for us. And again, if you could find the target, which wasn't too bad, some of the jungles and the Rivers looked fairly much the same, but again, good DR flight plan, that's all you needed. Go out on your tack end as far as you could, let down, and hold your heading. Again, the winds were negligible down there, so it had hardly any effect. You could get right to the target, and it didn't really matter about the weather. If a helicopter could get there, we figured we could, and this is what we did. We never aborted because of weather. And as far as seeing the targets in the jungle, of course, you never see them. You just see his smoke with the high tree canopy. But again, in the villages and bunkers and stuff, again, the tunnels underground they'd marked, it was hard to tell. You might see some fresh earth, but you just dropped your bomb according to where he said to, and then he'd tell the next man to move it over 10 meters or 20 or whatever he wanted, and you could do it. Actually, there wasn't any problem at all of firing at targets. Some of them, like footbridges, were hard to see when they called it, but again, if he marked it well or told you where he was in error when he did mark it, normally you'd be on target pretty soon.
What type ordnance did you use mostly, and on what type of targets?
Right, well, we used three types of ordnance. We used bombs, rockets, and NAEP. We used the Mark 79 and the 77 NAEP. Mark 79 was unsatisfactory. The first 12 napalm bombs we dropped in Vietnam, 11 of them were duds. After that, the Mark 77s turned out to be real fine. But I don't know if we didn't mix our NAEP right or what. Didn't let it gel long enough, but the charge on the 79s kept flying out, and I watched it because I was on this first flight. The bombs, we used Mark 81s, 2s, and 3s, which is 250, 500-pounders, and 1,000-pounders. Mainly, I'd say we used 250-pounders, and probably at least 50% of them. No, probably more than that, 60%, 250s. And then I think we only dropped 12,000-pounders the whole time when we were down there. No problems on the bombs, except, of course, the restriction of 550 knots, or you can arm them. Again, we found that you could drop bombs, and I did it personally, at 500 feet in level flight with this overcast weather. And it took 5 seconds for the bomb to hit the ground. You could cob it back into burner and go in through the clouds, and it would go off, and you didn't pick up any ricochets. And again, we found that the work that VX-5 had done in their advanced notes and in their publications, the only thing they had was a 10-degree dive and a 30-degree dive, which is ridiculous for combat because you have to give them air support if you get out there. That's what you're there for. And we found that we used a foot per pound. Well, actually, we never went any lower than about 500 feet on a 250-pounder, but I dropped 500-pounders, my flight did, at 500 feet. Nobody picked up any damage. And again, we figured out the mil setting, just started out with 190, 200 mils, and then the wingman could see where you hit. You'd tell them what you set, and you work it out, and pretty soon you're hitting pretty well right on target. But this type of information has to be available, and it wasn't. We had to find it out ourselves. The NWIP, I think it is 1-20, says that for, I think, a 500-pound bomb, you're supposed to have 1,100 feet or something in combat. It's completely erroneous. You can drop it in level flight if you got the power. And again, these runs were at 500 knots, 480 to 500. And if you got the power to, as soon as you drop it, you don't fly over the target, you bank your aircraft sharply in one direction or the other and pull it up. And we did it, we got away with it, and it worked real well, and I think everybody, except maybe a few, were convinced when we left. We had problems with our rockets. Again, we started firing point blank instead of the 3,000-foot slant range and all. The weather determined a lot of this, but we found that the Zuni rocket was so tremendous that if you fired in a 30-degree dive, it would just bury itself in the ground. So we fired level, as point blank as you could get it, and it wouldn't burn out when it hit. Everything it hit had knocked down, and it would run right through a town without completely from one end to the other, and doing tremendous damage. Talking to Air Force pilots, they figured that they were getting shot down with their 20 mic mics a lot because they'd stay there and fight back, but they were convinced that after watching us on targets with our Zunis that normally you'd make one or two passes the whole flight and you wouldn't get any more ground fire, and either you were getting them or they were running because the Zuni really, really worried them. The 2.75 rockets really weren't too good in the jungles. I guess they were better because they would detonate on contact with the upper canopy, and then you get ricochets, I guess, and shrapnel all around underneath. But using them in villages and all, unless you got a direct hit with it, you just had 19 holes in the ground, and this was borne out by the helicopter pilots who saw us prep zones. Again, we ended up firing them real flat, trying to get them ricochet, but they're so unpredictable, they don't go as true as the Zuni, that I'd rather have the Zuni rocket.
Did you work with an air support radar team?
Right. We worked many missions with the air support radar. And again, I think I had three or four missions with them. The first one worked out real well. I think it was the first one we dropped while we were down there. The skipper and myself went out on that. However, the next three or four, whatever I had missions after that, every single one of them was an abort due to the fact that we get airborne and it was such bad weather that the ASRAT could not pick us up. And we dropped between 16 and 21,000. They'd pick us up over the water when there weren't any thunderstorms, but we get back overhead, and the F-4 does not have a beacon. Now, it should have this beacon, as I mentioned before. And we can fly the exact altitude and the true airspeed right to the knot, which makes it a real find for the ASRAT people and their corrections. They noticed, they said, we're very small compared to the other airplanes due to the fact that with the heading hole capability in the airplane and all, that it makes it for very accurate bombing. Again, the limitation is the beacon. You need this because a surprise comes in the bad weather and at night. They did a real good job, I thought, the ASRAT people. They had it, it wasn't their fault they couldn't pick us up. But it seemed that when they did pick us up and we did drop, I remember one mission, 12 bombs, the worst one from a bunker was 60 meters off the target.
Can you give a brief description of an actual mission with an air support radar team, sir?
Right, well, we'd take off, and normally they'd brief us where they wanted us to go, and it'd be like on the 150 degree radial at 19 miles, say at 15,000 feet. Then they'd pick us up. Again, we did not have a beacon. Then they'd vector us around. Normally it'd be up to the north, then fly to the west, and then back in on a southerly heading, or 210 or something, into the target area. And they'd give you, they'd shoot for a 20,000 meter, I think it was, straight in. And they'd give you your last couple heading corrections, and then you just come right in, and they'd give you a standby to drop. And then I think they'd count it down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 or something, drop. Or they'd say, mark. And they gave you an Armstrong of 2,000 meters. And that's how it worked, and we just turned downwind again and go. Again, this is when we could drop.
What? Go ahead. What type of anti-aircraft fire did you encounter, and how effective was it?
Okay, well, I never encountered any. I never saw any. I heard rumor that there were a couple guns down there as far as flak. But the only type of anti-aircraft that we encountered at all was small arms, automatic weapons, 50 caliber. And we saw this quite frequently. But again, they were way behind us. And I think one thing to note is that we were making runs at 500 to 550, anywhere from 480 to 550, the limitation of the ordnance. And you could actually laugh at the fact that they'd be shooting at you. You could see the tracers going way below you or way behind you. But toward the end, I remember the last couple missions, it was really getting close, it looked like. So I think they're catching on a little bit under the speeds. And again, the big reason is most other airplanes delivered about 400 knots, the F-100s and all. And I think this is one thing that helped us. However, our 10 Ben in the squadron, the NCOIC of the metal shop, said he patched up 192 holes in our airplanes when we came back. And again, I never noticed any of mine. They might have been from rocket fins, they could have been small arms, maybe a few even our own blast. But again, it's an indication that the airplane can fly. I can only recall two times where the airplane was down due to hits, and one of them was the own bomb that went off under the airplane at 400 feet. He had armed the bomb, evidently by exceeding the speed limitations. When he dropped the bomb, a round or something hit it, because both the flight leader and the FAC saw it go off, estimated 400 feet below the airplane, and he lost his engine, one of his engines, and with the shrapnel from it. And then another time we had a rocket pod come off in flight and the drop, and it tore a third of the leading edge of the wing off the BLC flap. And again, he got it back. The pilot made a good landing, and the airplane was down, of course, so we could get a replacement on the flap.
Captain Sullivan, if you participated in helicopter escort missions, what tactics were used and how effective were they?
We did. We started out, again, we never did any of this in the past in our training, because I guess it's an attack mission, the helicopter escort. But we started out, we tried a four-plane to start with, we tried two-plane, we ended up with the best being a three-plane flight. And again, this was for 44 planes on down, 44 choppers on down. And what we did is we ran a racetrack pattern around them, started out a beam about the choppers about 100 yards, and above them, the last plane in the flight by about 1,000 feet. Again, you'd have about 250 knots. You'd come back to idle, you'd let down on a glide, stay in about 100 yards of beam, come along level with the lead aircraft, at which time then the lead chopper, you would honk it back up, full military power, and you'd have about 350 knots, and you'd climb back up on the other side of the circle, again to about 1,000 feet above them, fly along to the last chopper again, and then turn on your downwind. And we kept a plane, we figured, within 15 to 20 seconds all the time of the Roland heading, which would be above and behind them at about 250 knots. And again, the system was that if they had gotten hit from the ground, and they were going to break the chopper flight in the opposite direction, the man on the perch would roll in and fire rockets at him. Of course, that's all we had without the gun. Now, again, it worked out fairly well due to the fact that we had an RO in the back seat, because it was really hard to keep track of the green choppers over the green jungle and also your other airplanes. So this helps over a single-seat aircraft, but the F-4 is a little too big, I think, and clumsy. We even tried it half flaps once, which was unsat. It didn't work at all. Flaps would blow up, and you can't turn. It'd be an impossible situation, I thought. And again, I think the A-4 is probably better suited for this, except for the two-man capability. And if they put guns on the F-4, it might be all right. But I think guns on the A-4 is a much better system for helicopter escort than using F-4s for it.
To what extent was aerial photo recon utilized in support of both ground operations and air operations, sir?
Yeah, well, I don't... I only saw a couple pictures the whole time I was down there for missions up in the Balong Valley. And again, looking at the pictures that they'd taken, and when we flew over the target due to the cover weather and whipping around leading a flight, it was hard to really recognize it. And maybe we could have if there hadn't have been a airborne FAC there, but heck, he'd get there, he'd mark the target, and so really the pictures, as far as I was concerned, weren't of too much value. Again, because most of our targets were... they weren't the kind that really stuck out too well. If it had been a city, say, and pick out a certain quadrant, it would have probably helped a lot if they were up-to-the-minute pictures.
Could you give a brief description of the overall air control system employed in Vietnam?
No, again, the air control that we'd had before checking in with the TAC Center and all this, they were trying to set it up, but it would never work while we were there. In fact, it was a real lousy system. We had about three frequency change to make prior to getting on our FAC's frequency. And again, when you had a strike 3 miles off the end of the airstrip on a MAF alert, this was impossible. And so, heck, we used to just forget it, actually, and check in on the way back. If we had one, say, within 30 miles, you might get over to Panama, which is the GCI site in Rio with them. But the Marine people you're supposed to check in, half the time they weren't on the air. And I remember one time coming back from a mission, one of them was on the air on guard channel, screaming about somebody. They wanted to know if both airplanes were on the deck. And again, this was real disconcerting when you're running in on a strike trying to listen to the forward air controller. Again, I imagine this is probably taken care of now. But at the time, it was completely too many channel changes.
Explain to us what type aircraft is best suited for tactical observations.
Well, in my own mind, I think that the armed Huey, from what I saw of it out there, I thought it was outstanding. It's a little vulnerable. But again, you got six M60s on it, and that's a lot of firepower if they're all tracers. And I think he can see well and he can control well. The L-19 did an outstanding job, but he has no armament on it. And again, that would probably be second best. And of course, again, for being an airborne FAC or just observation, the AD Sky Raider would probably be about the next best. I feel a jet is really unsuited for any types of observation. Even in a open area, it's really hard to see, to slow it down. If you slow it down, you're going to get shot at. If you get down low enough where they can hit you a lot easier, whereas the Huey and the L-19 and all, AD, are much more maneuverable. And again, from what I saw, they did an outstanding job of it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to cover now some flight line operations, ground handling, which is a very important part of our operation down there. And to start with, let's talk about security. As far as I'm concerned, on the flight line, we had none. We had 8 aircraft facing 7. And we had 300 feet between the tail of the last airplane of one facing the opposite line and the tail of the other aircraft in the opposite line. They were packed so closely together that we had our wings folded, and we had to put jacks in the wings, because when you lose hydraulic pressure, the wings would have come down and they would have hit each other. All right, the security, we could not put sandbags out. We couldn't revet them anyway because we didn't have the room. Vietnamese, civilians and military, drove up and down our flight line at will with fuel trucks and everything you can think of. They stopped their vehicles, looked under the hood. Everything that could happen, happened. They had Vietnamese troops marching right by out of the C-123s that were parked next to us. Now, these guys had grenades and everything dangling from their equipment. And again, it just takes one to throw one down an intake or to have a satchel under one of these fuel trucks. And our flight line's going up in smoke. They get one airplane, they've got every one. Another thing is they had Vietnamese personnel working in the hangar. He was a caretaker. I think he was in the Vietnamese Air Force, but he sold hats and all that stuff. They had, as a crow fly, it's about a mile and a half from the center of our flight line to downtown Da Nang, I think, which has 65,000 people. A mortar, any mortar attack would wipe us out. Somebody could have a mortar tube in one of its huts someplace in any area there, and if they get to us on our line, we've had it. They get one again, they'll get all of them. Another problem we had was with our refueling. Now, we had the Taftas, which worked out real well, except we didn't get fuel lots of times. So we had a 60,000-gallon, of course, capability, but the fuel was trucked in on the base, and then it had to be sampled, and the sample were taken down to Saigon. And we couldn't get the fuel until it had been checked. And many times I've seen our bags get down to 3,000 gallons in one bag, the other's flat, and we couldn't put any add-on missions because, and we had the airplanes due to the fact we didn't have the fuel. Also, we had four refueling hoses coming out of our Taftas. We didn't use these hot refueling, though, because when you refuel four aircraft at once, the pressure is so low that it took forever to refuel it and was so hot that we just put our probes out prior to shutdown, which conditioned the airplane for cool power refueling, and then let the plane captains refuel the airplane and then tow them back into position. We did the most of the maintenance right there on the flight line. If it was serious maintenance or a check, we pulled the planes into the hangar. Normally, we had a hangar queen in there, something that we would cannibalize and get our parts from if we didn't have them. The maintenance people did an outstanding job on keeping the airplanes up and doing regular line maintenance. Again, I told you how cluttered the area was, the flight line. Again, with all the ground support equipment and bombs and everything sitting out there, we really had problems. We were blowing plane captains around, taxiing out, because you had to put a lot of power on to move the aircraft with all the bomb loads we had. And really, it sort of took heads up ball here, and it really was a dangerous situation, but it was all we had. Again, security, the lack of it could have really cost us the whole squadron. Again, our ordnance, the bombs and rockets were sitting right out in the open about, maximum of 30 yards from the airplane. We had, I'd say, about a 40 or 50 yard area where we kept the ordnance, and again, that wasn't across the field, but there was nothing else we could do about it. The weather, I think, had a big part to play in keeping our airplanes up, that it was warm weather. We didn't lose too many seals or anything, but dust was a major problem. The fact we had to put dust covers on everything, otherwise we'd lose, due to the communications equipment in the airplane, with the block that the pilot plugs in, this would go out very easily. But after we figured this out, which is a couple days, we had dust covers on everything. Again, the instruments would get dirty, but the plane captains would just have to keep wiping them off. Our ground handling equipment, our starting pods and all stood up real well. We had some regular GTC-85 backups for our 105s, and I don't think we ever had to use one. We got down to one starting pod a couple times out of six or five. I'm not sure the number we had, but as a rule, they stood up real well. Again, we were augmented from MABS when we first went down there, or HAMS people, to maintain these. One of the problems, again, with the rockets that I failed to mention were our racks ourselves, the MERS and TERS. After sustained operations, it took about 2 weeks these Zunis. And then we found out that the racks were shorting out. The Zuni with the heat was so great that it would melt the wires, and therefore you couldn't get anything off normally, or you'd fire it and it would short out. In the next flight, they wouldn't know this, and he wouldn't be able to fire. And if it popped the circuit breaker in the RO's cockpit, no matter what you did, if you held it in or what, you wouldn't drop anything off the airplane at all, other than by jettisoning everything off the airplane. So, of course, we brought it back. There was no abort gear at Da Nang. The Air Force wouldn't let us put it out there due to the fact that it would. They said it was bad for their tires. When we left, they put in, I think, an abort gear on the end of the runway, but we couldn't put our Morist in the middle. And again, this, if you had a utility failure or something, it could cause you'd lose an airplane for a relatively minor emergency because you did not have the abort gear. And the abort gear that they did put up there toward the end was, I think, 75 feet from the end, and nobody had ever flown into it before, and they said, well, it's supposedly okay. I'm not sure if it is or not, and again, I don't know if it's been utilized. The tire problem that we had when we first got there, we didn't have all general tires. We had to change the tires after every three takeoffs and landings over 49,500. But when we got the general tires, the 26-ply tires, I think we had one blown tire the whole time we were down there, and that was on takeoff. And it worked out. Actually, those tires were outstanding.
Thank you, Captain Sullivan, for this interview.